Yeah, I don't know, man. You ever just feel like life is just catapulting towards some greater purpose?
With bloated ego, we are the only DJ crazy enough to tattoo Jackie Brown on his ass.
Yeah, this is Michael Mann, and I ride with
extended clip.
Yeah,
but there's a lot of ballparks you can get to from here.
I know. I'm super excited. Nico and I really want to get into baseball tourism.
I will gladly tag along if I can afford any of them. That's always been a dream for me, because in LA, it's like you have Dodger Stadium, Angel Stadium. Petco Park's only twice as far as Angel Stadium. Honestly, it's not that bad. But other than that, it's like you got to drive a long way to get to another ballpark. And baseball stadiums are all unique. I don't know. Some of our listeners aren't, you know, baseball fans. I know one friend of the pod, Alex, I went to a Blue Jays game with him, and he had been living in Toronto for a while and been to a couple Blue Jays games. His first experiences with American baseball, because he was an Englander who moved to Toronto as a man in his 20s. And when I told him that the dimensions in the outfield were different at different major league ballparks, he had a fit not unlike a certain Dustin Hoffman character. Like he was so upset by that knowledge.
I really like the bank. It's awesome. Yeah. And I mean, just being able to like just hop on the Broad Street line and get there and come back is so perfect.
Yeah, shout out to SEPTA. You know, we got some great transit out here.
That's one of the big reasons that the A's, at least that what they blamed it on, didn't stay in Oakland, because like the BART was unwilling to like stop there or something like that. Something to do with like the public transit. At least was one of the big, I think the real big reasons that the owner wanted like a ton of money from the city of Oakland. And they're not, you know, it's not so prosperous right now. So I remember once, as a kid, we knew this family that, they had fall ball tickets. Like it's kind of like the inverse of spring training, where it's like all the top prospects like play in like leagues versus each other, an exhibition league for like minor league stars. It was pretty cool. And it's, you know, obviously if you want to get into like low end baseball, like AAA, AA, you know, you're looking at like dollar tickets. You know what I mean? I want to get into like minor league baseball. I want to see like the minor league teams around, because I feel like that's like a very specific vibe.
Even the independent minor leagues too, like unaffiliated with any major league squads, is like great. Like I saw some New England minor league baseball when visiting family out there, and it's sick. Like seeing the Brockton Rocks, that stadium in Brockton, Massachusetts, where everything in the fucking city is named after Rock Marciano.
That's crazy.
Anyway. Welcome to Extended Clip. It is episode 283, and I am one of your hosts, Eddie Averill.
I'm Malcolm Baugh.
I'm JT White.
And today, the main topic of our episode is perhaps one of the greatest films by the Brothers Farrelly. We're talking about the 2003 comedy, Stuck on You, starring Matt Damon and Greg Kinnear. But before that, we have a new segment on the podcast. Now, this was inspired by our previous episode on the Patreon, and I've taken some time in the week since that episode in podcast time, in the 30 minutes in real time, to flesh this out a little bit. So before we start, I'm going to play a game with the two of you, okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Malcolm, I'm going to play a game inspired by both the works of Radu Jude and Robert Pollard. The game is this a film that played at Cannes or the name of a Guided by Voices song? Are you guys ready to play?
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
I think this should be a challenging game. I'm like loosely familiar with Guided by Voices.
Yeah. And hey, Harris, would you like to play a game with us real quick on the air? I'm going to make this more of a game show format here, if Harris is so kind to join us in the first like inaugural. Yeah, it's the inaugural edition of Is This a Film That Played at the Cannes Film Festival, or is this the name of a Guided by Voices song? So how I'm going to do it is I will say the title. Each of you will lock in your answer, and then I will reveal who is right and wrong.
Okay.
Do you all understand the basic setup of the game and the rules?
Yeah, I think I do.
First up, over your cities, grass will grow.
Guided by Voices.
Yeah, I'm gonna go Guided by Voices too.
Guided by Voices.
That played at the 2010 Cannes Film Festival.
Damn it.
damn. It was a little long.
We won't apologize for the human race.
I'm gonna go Guided by Voices again.
Voices. I'm gonna go Can. I'm gonna zag.
It was Guided by Voices.
Okay. Nah, fuck.
Yes.
I have the zero on Jeopardy right now. I'm the failing member.
As we go up, we go down.
Can.
Guided by Voices. I
Guided by Voices.
Yeah, yeah, that, yeah. I know that one. I know that damn. One. I can terrorize. I
see terror in your eyes as we go. The agony and sweat of human spirit.
Can.
Guided by Voices?
I'll go Guided by Voices too.
The answer is the Cannes Film Festival.
God damn it.
I keep thinking like that title's just too much for a Cannes movie. That's like yeah, a parody, no, exactly, of a Cannes movie, but then it actually turns out to be real. So, you know, you got to assume differently.
The unsinkable Fats Domino.
Guided by Voices.
Guided by Voices?
Guided by Voices.
That is Guided by Voices. You guys all got that one. Let's
Fats Domino is music. So you
well,
know
yeah, but there could
music.
Have been a documentary that played out of competition about Fats yeah.
True.
Domino. Yeah. The Snows of Kilimanjaro.
Can.
Everyone got that one. I am already everything I want to have.
Guided by Voices.
Guided by Voices.
Can,
God
baby.
Damn it.
Oh. That played 2011 Cannes Film Festival. I am already everything I want to have. What a horrible movie title. And that, ladies and gentlemen, has been the inaugural edition of Is This a Guided by Voices Song or a Film That Played at the Cannes Film Festival? Karis, thank you so much for joining us. This was DJ Karisine joining us with a new DJ set sometime coming on SoundCloud. Thank you, Karis.
Thank you for having me.
That was good.
That was,
I like
that.
It
was fun.
I like
playing games. Yeah. Dream on, child of change. Throw your javelin through the sun. Pierce the hearts of everyone. Though we push to slave the days. This is not reality. This is just formality. The cup is only being filled for a chance to have it spilled, flowing just like the days, sailing just like the days, flowing just like the days, sailing just like the days, flowing just like the days, sailing just like the days.
Stuck on You, 2003, The Farrelly Brothers. Now, these guys know about fun and games. We've been talking about the segment of screenwriting formula called fun and games that comes after the first act break since the very first episode of this podcast. And who fulfills that promise of the premise better than the Farrelly Brothers in their movies in general? And then of their movies, which one has the most, like, promise of the premise? Like, you see a poster with a high concept and then you know you're gonna get all the gags for it. It's actually kind of a toss-up, but this is up there for Stuck on You. If you don't know, it is the Matt Damon Greg Kinnear conjoined twins movie, and all I can say to start off is that we are all huge fans of this one, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
Well, no, end was of it, episode. Yeah, it, I also
no,
realized
no other notes needed.
Yeah. My Audacity is not recording.
Oh man.
I'm recording. I'm always. I'll just tell you when I start recording Audacity.
My Zoom has been recording the whole time. It's all good. We got the segment on Zoom. Mm-hmm. I'm very annoyed at myself because I pulled up Audacity this time.
I should have called you out on it this time.
See,
I'm
the
so sorry.
Numbers right
I'm
there. They
so
should
sorry.
Be fucking clicking. You know.
It was the game. You're excited about the game, and then you forgot.
I was
to do the Audacity.
Yeah.
I cannot overstate how
Eddie
excited
had
I was to play a
running
game
around the apartment. Just.
just double screening like Guided by Voices discography, 2011 Cannes Film Festival lineup, just fucking stimming out so hard, dude. So much.
I think that's the happiest I've ever seen him.
My phone was charging like on a very low port, like low to the ground. So I was just like hunched over doing quote unquote research for that for like 15 minutes between our last segment and this one. And I felt good. I felt good. So Stuck on You opens with Here Comes Your Man by the Pixies, and there's another Pixies needle drop later on. And I think, you know, soundtracking is a good way to start with the Farrelly Brothers, because it's been in their DNA since the get-go. Dumb and Dumber, I think, has like 350 songs in it, probably.
Yeah. Kingpin, but also, I remember, yeah, being soundtrack heavy.
Kingpin has that one ska song from Tony Hawk in it twice.
Oh, yeah. The Kingpin soundtracks are wild.
They are kind of the people who established like what everyone came to know as just like comedic studio filmmaking montages set to popular kind of rock type music, you know, because of Dumb and Dumber and because of Kingpin and stuff. And that had existed before, but I feel like they really established a style that was so clear. And that's why I like the weirder they get throughout their filmography. I mean, Me, Myself, and Irene, the concept of that soundtrack is a bunch of different people doing Steely Dan covers, including Smash Mouth, which is just, I can't say it's good music, but it's very interesting as a concept for a comedy movie. And Jonathan Richman, and
Richman and There's Something About Mary. Yeah, that's like one of their more kind of like thoughtful, you know, not that these other ones, but it's like, you know, he's like a character in the movie. It's like kind of less like popish music, you know what I mean? Or like big hits, because something that the Farrellys like to do, they like to spend their soundtrack budget. And I think I appreciate that just on like a pure entertainment level. Like the Farrellys always like aim to entertain. Like I know we kind of, you know, we had a series, you know, where we, you know, dive deeper into their movies.
We actually did it. That does not exist anymore. We never have talked about the Farrelly Brothers on this podcast.
Oh shit. Well, hypothetically, in a past life that doesn't exist, we might have done that. Or even in our own times, we've spread the word of Farrelly and like, you know, diving deep into their movies. There's stuff to, you know, glean from that. Just on a pure like surface level, they also just like aim to entertain like a random moviegoer with kind of like what you said, with the promise of the premise, giving the people what they want in the trailer. And then, you know, they always have their montage big song moments. You know, it's very I like the attitude, you know, they mean to please.
Yeah, and in addition to just wanting to please people with funny, gross-out gags and fun music, it's like, if you haven't, you know, seen us talk about them or read anything we've ever posted online or on Letterboxd about them or whatever, like, what separates them from other just gag and stunt comedians, like, we also adore Adam Sandler, but the Farrellys have a certain dramatic sensibility that is very underrated. And I feel like Stuck on You and Something About Mary are probably the strongest cases for them as like kind of classic comedic filmmakers, where it's not these like high concept 90s style comedies so much as these old school Hollywood movies that just tell a full story that happened to be very funny. You know, like I know it's not the most trendy name to talk about, but the way that the Farrelly Brothers dramatics are shaped in their movies reminds me almost like of Billy Wilder, if Billy Wilder had a much raunchier sensibility, you know. At the same time, though, it's much less tightly wound, and they understand the freedom that came with New Hollywood and those movies they grew up on, like Easy Rider and stuff, and the ability to have lax pacing on the road and let guys just hang out and let needle drops carry the weight and stuff. And that's why their films are often longer than the average comedy movie, you know? But it's those moments of length that are always like slyly intimate with the characters, and they make the dramatic beats get pulled off so much easier when you spend time with characters just doing nothing, being themselves, you know? And the Farrellys are so good at creating great situations for characters to expose who they are, you know?
Yeah, I think for me, sort of the peak of like really why I love their style is it's kind of the mix of that, the human touch and like cynical kind of mean comedy, especially with something like this, like Shallow Hal. I feel like you go into movies with a particular idea, especially a gross out comedy. You go into a movie with the idea that like, oh, this is going to be have a negative treatment of the characters. And it does, like, certainly, like, the characters will go through a lot. They'll get beaten up. Some people are like the butt of jokes, but they're also very sweet, beautiful, tender moments that occur that I don't want to say undercut the cruel comedy, but add like a fully realized world to it and a depth of character that you wouldn't expect from something that leans so goofy. In my opinion, it's like the ideal for like the type of movie that I want to make. Something that has like insane like comedy and can go incredibly broad, but then also can bring it back to character moments. I mean, Stuck on You for me, like from the very beginning, I mean, maybe it's the fact that I've seen this like maybe three or four times now, but I get choked up like from the very beginning at just like very tender parts of it where, and I mean, I'm sure we'll get into the representation of disabled characters in the Farrelly filmography at some point. But when Kinnear and Damon are working in the burger joint at the beginning, and one of their like sort of like waiters is accosted for being slow, the way they stick up for him in like a way that's like not like corny and earnest and is not like doesn't feel like something that's like trying to pinpoint in a message is just so true to the core of the characters and just I don't know, it's so human and sweet. And right from the very beginning, I feel like you know what kind of movie you're going to get.
Yeah, I feel like the that opening scene of them at the restaurant is such a great way to read the whole movie because you have the really well choreographed and put together montage of them assembling a table's worth of burgers for what they call a tester at their high concept restaurant where, you know, if the food isn't delivered to your table within a few minutes, it's free and there's a buzzer and everything. And it's a very elaborate setup. And, you know, this is another sidebar. Part of what sets the Farrellys apart also, what makes their film so watchable is that they are all about the details at every level. The production design of these movies is, I'm not going to say classic Hollywood level, but way more thoughtful than other comedy movies. Like when they have ideas, it's not like an Apatow movie where someone has an idea and they riff it out on set because like you get to do 100 takes with either Adam McKay or Judd Apatow and one of your comedic ideas goes that way. For them, like their ideas are in the script and in the production design and in the cinematography and framing and staging. Like they're not show-off visual stylists by any means. They make very plain looking films, but then when you actually break down the mise-en-scene, it's like, oh, these guys are framing things in a very classical way, especially in this film with the wide lensing and everything and using two people together and everything. So regardless, I wanted to just also state that about the Farrelly brothers as I get into that opening scene, which is so great. Yeah, so you have that really well executed montage, and then you have the guy, as you said, they kick him out of the restaurant and everything, and it's just such a great way to really quickly like establish both the brothers' professional partnership and the community that they've cultivated at their restaurant. And it's just like a fun 4-minute little segue, but it's just everything you need about the exposition of the film right away. And I just find them so efficient. And also, it's such a real atmosphere in that restaurant. Like, if Howard Hawks made this movie, it would never leave that restaurant. You know?
That would be good to see in Only Angels Have Wings, but set in this, restaurant. Yeah, you know, it's funny. You're talking about the production design. I was kind of taken aback by the production design in this movie, too, in a way I hadn't really considered in Farrelly movies before. But yeah, it's like just talking about the beginning, like the environment of like Martha's Vineyard and kind of, you know, specifically their burger joint that they own feels so lived in, and it, you really feel like the specificity that they, you know, I think they're somewhat familiar with the area, right? Them, like, growing up in Rhode Island, or at least, no. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, Fairly Brothers are familiar with. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I thought you meant those characters, right? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, they live there. Yeah, that's
well,
where
I was going to say, that's what I was going to get at is, like, they're like the fucking kings of the town almost, but it's totally. it's a take on that because Kinnear is the king of the town and Damon is still kind of shy and like he has his moments of, you know, the stage fright when Kinnear is doing his one man shows, which, you know, that's a great ironic bit, of course, of, you know, but it's also, it's not just the irony of a set of conjoined twins, one of them doing a one man show. The Fairley Brothers tease that out into the drama of the movie, of course. It's not just a quick sight gag for a sketch show. That is the point of the movie. Greg Kinnear wants to go out to Hollywood, you know, and there's motivation for Matt Damon there too, because as Greg Kinnear puts it, hey, I see you downloaded another picture of your California internet girlfriend. What's her name again? Poontang? So Matt Damon has been cultivating this relationship online with a woman who he hasn't told he is part of a conjoined twin, and as we've been saying since day one, every romantic comedy is just about lying and pretending to be someone else, and this plays that game for about an hour, and I love when they do that, you know.
I mean, it's so funny because it's like, if this relationship's ever gonna go anywhere, it's like he has to tell her eventually, yeah. Right? Like, it is like the ultimate like gags and stunts portion. Just how do you even like hide that? And it finds like many creative ways throughout the movie, you know, to do that. The fun of the conjoined twins aspect is something that's throughout the movie. There's a lot of creativity there of just like thinking of scenarios where the, you know, where these conjoined twins could kind of use like their talents of being like two people. Like the sports sequence is really hilarious to me.
Multiple sports montages. You could tell the Fairley Brothers were just so excited to do all the sports montages of these conjoined twins, and it's awesome. It looks great. They do like little tricky stuff, like a pickoff move when they're both a pitcher, and the one being the caddy and the other one swinging the golf club is very funny.
You know, in a much lesser way, but kind of same with the drama stuff. You know, comes back later in the movie where, like, doesn't a character say, like, I saw you guys play, like, or was it Meryl Streep's character? Is like, I saw you play legendary high school football game, you know, where you scored a bunch of points. And the one that cracks me up the most is just the boxing one, because it's just two of them beating up one guy. It's just not even any trick to it. They're just, you know, four sets of hands wailing on you. It's just very plainly hilarious. And you could almost see, like, the genesis of this movie maybe even starting with like those scenes. Oh, that would be a great scenario for some comedy. Yeah. And it is
absolutely, but of course, yeah, there's such underrated and skilled dramatists that they make it into a full 2-hour movie that's really fulfilling in my opinion.
So, yeah, and it's also more dramatically weighted than I kind of remember even in my last viewing, because I think you kind of mentioned like it is just a lot of it is just dealing with, you know, the X's and O's, I guess you would say, of being of a conjoined twin and, you know, how that could affect your life and whatnot. And, you know, it takes those considerations very seriously.
And the back half is also about the idea of them separating and, you know, how they could possibly live life like that. While, you know, Greg Kinnear might want to for the sake of his acting career or something like that, you know. And so they go to California, and I just, speaking of the maximum effort they put in, I love that opening shot of them in Hollywood, like this gigantic epic crane shot from fucking six stories up swooping down on them on Hollywood Boulevard, just full of like people in costumes and homeless people and tourists and stuff like that, just showing how awful and decrepit Hollywood is. Just for that quick sight gag of them being like, are we sure we're at the right Hollywood and Vine?
And then when they, you know, move into the Los Angeles, you know, Hollywood apartments, I feel like that's like kind of an underrated, not set piece, but just a location throughout the movie that's just really well-defined.
It's another community they cultivate too, like between the dude who runs the establishment and their neighbor who becomes the romantic interest, of course, and some other passersby once in a while, you know, it's like, it's their little home away from home, and they joke and get around, goof off the same way, and the guy who works behind the counter of the hotel ends up being the head writer of the TV show that Greg Kinnear stars in.
Yeah, and that almost kind of has like a classic Hollywood setting feel to it, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, it's definitely more low end, but maybe even almost something like hot, like a low end version of like the community that's in like In a Lonely Place or whatever, kind of a stretch.
Yeah, right.
But I just like, it is like, especially with this and Shallow Hal, like they're kind of similar movies in that like they both really look kind of like expensive, and like I'm really kind of impressed by the cinematography in kind of sneaky ways. And I guess just in a nut, like they both kind of, you know, I think with the previous Farrelly movies, you know, there was some emotionality to them, especially like There's Something About Mary, but they, you know, ultimately take the side of like comedy. And like, you know, like you think about like the ending of those movies, there's a very emotional ending in Mary, but then, you know, it's undercut with like a guy getting shot or whatever, like
Jonathan Richmond getting shot.
Getting shot. I was confused. I kind of forgot if it was the old man who gets shot, but he does the shooting.
He shoots him and reveals that he was only sleeping with the old lady to get to Mary.
Yeah. Amazing movie. Yeah. But yeah, like Shallow Hal and Stuck on You, it kind of takes like these on paper kind of like ridiculous premises and finds, I think in Stuck on You, it's a very direct way. And, you know, in Shallow Hal, it is, I guess, you know, it's something about that is a little bit more complicated now, but like it's maybe somewhat direct, just really Shallow Hal, it's like somewhat indirect. I'm kind of rambling here, I'm sorry, but
you're absolutely on the right point, because Shallow Hal, as goofy as that high concept premise is, the emotionality, the crux of it is the film, where it reveals it's not just about like quote unquote beauty, like hot girls, but when it's revealed that he has been seeing these like, you know, disabled burn victims as just like, you know, quote unquote normal kids the whole time.
After the gold rush, young needle drop there.
Oh man, that song is playing and he goes to that ward again and like sees those kids as they actually are, and not just like, it kind of reveals a lot about the movie, where it's not about male sexuality as much as you think it is. It's more about perception and just how people see the world and other people. And it's a smarter movie than you would think because of that. And, you know, I'm gonna rewatch it soon and figure out some more about that one. But I really agree with you, Malcolm. Post Something About Mary, I think they had enough confidence with that. They'd had hits in a row. 20th was like, yeah, do what you want, you know. And I feel like they really consciously wanted to move toward a more dramatic style. And it really fucking works for those two movies, I think. I mean, Shallow Hal, you get away with it with the marketing easily. Totally. This one, you also get away with the marketing, but it's like, it's a much heavier dramatic movie. Shallow Hal has like, it's like a 20-minute aside of drama. And then this one is like a real 2-hour dramatic movie that happens to be funny the whole time.
The richness of character that both have, like, and I'll try to avoid talking about Shallow Hal too much, but I think with the inciting, I don't know if you'd necessarily call it the inciting incident, but like the key sort of opening scene where you unlock Hal's, like, why he is so vain is like his dying dad being like, you should get pussy, like as much pussy as possible, which is like played like funny, but also is just like paint, like a very sad, warped, tragic thing to say to a boy. And you again, it like builds the depth of this character. And I think the same thing applies to Stuck on You, where like it's obviously a very genius like writerly move to be like, oh, okay, well these brothers like are going to be very different people but glued together, and you can mine a lot of comedy from like the disability in its own right, just like the fact that there are the contrasts between them. But the nature of having like two characters that have lived like just side by side their entire lives, there's such an affection that the two of them have for one another that like I don't see a way that you can go like make a film like this and not have that be the case, because just, I don't know, it's such a key point to who they are.
Before they leave, I love that last beat before they pack up and go and everything, is Greg Kinnear, like just to show how different they are in terms of like relationships and stuff. They already did one scene showing like one of them flirting and then the other one failing, and then you see Greg Kinnear hooking up with the girl and there's like a shower curtain almost over the bed. I don't know how they did, or no, is he just off to the side of the bed on the floor or something?
No, there's like a curtain between that, like splitting the bed.
And so mid sex Greg Kinnear pokes his head out to check in on Matt Damon, make sure he's okay, and he sees that he's using the computer.
I'm sorry, mind tapping on your knees? Okay,
here we go. It always takes me a second to register that they have the same sperm count basically. And he is mid-coitus seeing that his conjoined twin is using a laptop on his balls, basically. And I honestly think that's one of the more insane jokes about, like, the premise, like, promise of the premise type jokes in the whole movie. And it always catches me off guard. It's so stupid.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a question, you know, a simple-minded Joes, you know, want to know. It's like, how do these guys have sex? And, it's pretty funny, you know, scenario, just having to ignore that as the Matt Damon character, you know, pretty devastating in a way. But he's so used to it by then, it's not even really, you know, that much of an issue, although I'm sure he's slightly annoyed by it.
So after they get to Hollywood, you know, we meet the Eva Mendes character, who Greg Kinnear kind of forms like a friendly attachment to, flirtatious friendly, you know, throughout the movie. And it's she honestly plays the comedy really well. I feel like the Farrelly brothers are really good at, you know, figuring out how to, like, because, you know, the fact is they're making kind of bro movies, quote unquote. They're making movies that are going to have a very largely male audience. And to figure out how to write, you know, women characters that men are going to want to watch but aren't sacrificing them as characters, you know, it's kind of a finer line than you would think, I guess. Like, the difference between Mary from Something About Mary and Eva Mendes in this movie is fucking miles apart. Like, but I think that's probably just a show of contrast for them in this one, as she is kind of a prototypical kind of ditzy aspiring actress, but she, I don't know, delivers the lines with such conviction that every, like, dumb thing or, like, malpropism that she says, like, fucking kills me, but doesn't make me think of her character as, like, a lesser person or anything like that. Yeah. It's just the very basic funny premise of a dumb person being confident, you know? Yeah. And that's always funny.
And I mean, there's a full range of, like, characters. Yeah. Like, Damon's girlfriend is, like, an entirely different, like, rich personality of, like, very high strung, anxious. Mm-hmm. You get, like, the hilarious, like, Cher cameo. Yeah. It's, like, longer than
third build. She's, like, the third actor in this movie.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it feels like it's something that is, like, kind of the celebrity cameo thing. Like, like her playing herself is very...
Yeah, she's playing herself, but I feel like that makes the movie more of, like, a somewhat meta thing than it is a cameo, because it's, like, that's the drama of the movie, is that, you know, Greg Kinnear gets on a TV show with Cher because Cher, you know, chewed him out, and then, you know, on accident, for whatever reason, they accidentally stumble into her, it's called trailer, and then she, because of contract disputes, is going producer's mode and wants to make the worst TV show possible so it'll get canned right away to get out of a contract. So she gets Greg Kinnear, because, you know, who would want to watch a show with conjoined twins or whatever? Little does she know, Greg Kinnear has that magic in him.
Greg Kinnear in this film, like, I just...
So good.
Yeah, one of... I mean, I love Greg Kinnear in general, and it really disappoints me that he doesn't have more starring roles. But this is, like, his best performance. He just is electric with charisma. I also, like, the hair, just, like, the long, flowing blonde hair. Oh, my God.
No, he's, like, kind of the perfect line of, like, kind of, like... super confident dude, but who, like, you know, is also nice and kind and caring. You know, obviously there's, you know, there's a, like Eddie was saying, there's, like, a fine line with certain characters. And yeah, I think Greg Kinnear, you know, he's a very layered guy. Obviously, you know, he loves ladies, loves flirting, but he's also, you know, and is a really thoughtful thespian, you know, really like you know, takes the act of the art of acting seriously,
but also and, does not understand social cues at all in real life. Like, he is way less graceful. That, like, he understands how to flirt with women and stuff like that, but then you get that scene where he runs into Meryl Streep at the restaurant, and before she recognizes them from the football game, it's like maybe the best comedy of embarrassment in a scene of the Farrelly Brothers, where Matt Damon attached to him is just trying to drag him away. Like, we can't be bothering Meryl Streep at lunch right now, you know, but he's also in on it too, like trying to say stuff. But when Greg Kinnear just goes, you know,
I can't believe you just come to a restaurant, nobody bugs you.
Fucking kills me every time. Oh my God.
You know, he's got the blinders on because he's so confident. You know, it takes a certain type of guy to not recognize that, you know what I mean? And kind of power through and still smile while he's and talking,
like,
to you.
There's the angle of him being like naive in Hollywood too. Yeah. That's just like the fact that he doesn't know that Cher like hates him and is playing him as a bit like in the beginning is just so funny.
And him showing up at that porn movie, you know, what was it? Pavlov's Dong.
Yeah.
That's actually, I forgot about that rewatching it. That's hilarious. And like kind of maybe the meanest the humor gets towards the conjoined buddies that we're watching, but very funny. Funny,
yeah, because they were being thrown in as the quote-unquote freaks in a weird porno, you know, Pavlov's Dong. Also, the porno Pavlov's Dong was also shot at Half Mast Studios.
That's such a funny studio name for like multiple reasons.
Yeah. So as we were saying, you know, the Eva Mendes character comes in, then Meryl Streep slow kind of enters the picture through that cameo scene, like opening a back door for herself to come through again in the end. And then we also have Cher. And then, of course, we have Mei Fong. This is Matt Damon's internet girlfriend from California. And that first date where he's hiding being conjoined twins and they're just in the car going to Jack in the Box and like the drive through at Jack in the Box and parking by the pier and talking is one of my favorite scenes in any Farrelly Brothers movie. When Kinnear brings up Annie Hall.
You guys remember that Woody Allen movie? I think it was Annie Hall, where the guy goes out with the girl and to try and ease the tension, he suggests they kiss at the beginning of the date instead of the end of the date.
Right. Yes!
Do you remember this? No. The best scene is when Diane Keaton's brother says that he's going to drive headfirst into the truck and like kill everybody in the car.
Is one of the most relatable things ever. Just so good. And it's just like it's relentless with like clever staging the entire movie. It's like every scene we're describing, the logistics of how it's all staged is so clever. And you know, I was gonna say the use of widescreen is really good. This is the first time they've used scope in their movies, I'm pretty sure. Maybe Kingpin was, but I'm like 99% sure that at least Dumb and Dumber, Something About Mary and Shallow Hal were all 185. And I feel like the scope adds like a certain grandiosity to this in addition to the production design and everything. I mean, it's a story set in Hollywood. They're on the 20th Century Fox lot. When they meet Cher, there's a giant fucking wall mural for Revenge of the Sith, maybe, or Attack of the Clones. But you have Darth Vader on a wall mural there. I did a little lightsaber when I said Darth Vader there. Did you notice that? I feel like they really are leaning fully into this being like their most accomplished dramatic film. There was handsome visual film. It didn't turn out that way in terms of like critical response or box office, but I really think if you're tracking the trajectory of their career from the early films to Mary to this, it's like it really felt like they were going for broke here. And to me, that's what makes it, if not their very best film, at least the second best, you know.
It's definitely like their most complex film, I think. There's like a lot of things going on. You kind of addressed it already, but it's like, yeah, this is like a Hollywood satire in addition to like everything else. Like there's a good like 30 to 45 minutes kind of dealing with like, you know, disabled representation in Hollywood, you know, them being a conjoined twins. It's, you know, maybe a unique representation, not something you see a whole lot, you know, maybe you think of it kind of differently compared to others, but like Yeah, it is like a lot of this movie kind of deals with that and is like one of the dramatic cruxes of the movies. You know, Kinnear not liking how like they treat, or just kind of like the weird treatment he gets, being like, oh, he's the conjoined twin superstar. Him kind of wrestling with that is very interesting.
I also really like once he gets the show on the air and everything, you cut back to the vineyard, to the restaurant where the whole crew is watching the pilot. And just like knowing that they've already established a new community in LA and everything, and then seeing that community established back at the vineyard at the restaurant, cheering them on and everything and goofing off, and, you know, one of them blowing smoke rings with this weird device. Like, it's just, it's very heartwarming, I gotta say. It's just something that, like, it feels very classic Hollywood in the sense of just, like, camaraderie between characters. And even if it's not, like, a quote-unquote realistic scene you would walk into off the street, it feels so real within the world of the film, at least.
And it's just, like, such a pure, unnecessary, like, indulgence. Like, yeah. I mean, obviously, it's not, because it serves the purpose of showing the, is it Honey and the Bees?
Yeah, Honey and the Bees.
Show, like a way to frame that, which I think is very clever, but you don't need the hometown reaction. I think it's just a lovely little flourish that just like expands out the world a little bit more. And I wanted to like return to, I suppose, what Malcolm was getting at in terms of like, disability representation and sort of the sneaky sort of angle there. I feel like it tackles that, particularly when they like separate, in a way that's like meaningful, because it's like they, I don't know, I feel like it's hard for the film to advocate for them to like come back together, or that like, that's ridiculous. Obviously, it's like generally a major hindrance. And after they've made that step, there's no like turning back to that. And I think that it would be foolish to make that argument, but it really celebrates their difference in a way. I mean, again, like you get a bunch of like jokes at the expense of it, and I think it's mined for comedy, but never in like a, like the joke is again, never on like the fat, like never at them for being disabled.
So Seymour Castle plays their very old school agent who they get at a retirement home, who bursts through doors on his old people scooter, which is very funny. When Mei Fong first finds out that they are conjoined twins, it's a crazy like hierarchy of reactions and embarrassments, kind of, where at first she thinks they're gay brothers.
Oh yeah,
because she sees them sleeping in the same bed. And then she finds out that they're conjoined twins and gets even more freaked out and drives away. And because of that scene, everyone on the street recognizes them and it's all exposed and everything. And then we get a little like satire of media, I guess, in terms of how people are covering that as being like, oh my God, the show's going to get canceled. It turns out this guy's a freak, you know? and then you got Seymour Castle just being like, you got to just deny, deny, deny.
I think
it's very funny.
It is very fun. And like, that's the thing. It's like, it mines humor out of, you know, their situation, right? Like I think we've said the term fine line a lot in this, but it is like a fine line of like, they're in on the joke because it is like, there's humor to be found in that situation. But I don't know. There's just like a delicacy to it, to where that like, it doesn't feel like mocking, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Obviously we've seen so much of their life and their humanity, and there's serious scenes where we, you know, consider their emotions, and like, you know, even those scenes are a little bit funny, you know, like thinking of like Greg Kinnear hugging the statue to kind of feel we're not going to use the term Siamese twins here. They're not Siamese, as Matt Damon said.
We're not Chinese, we're American.
so funny. Like, you know, to get some of that, he's hugging the statue, obviously, to kind of simulate the conjoined twin factor there. But, and that, like, I feel like that's a great scene because it's genuinely touching. It's kind of a very moving image, but there's also something a little bit funny about that, obviously, too.
I mean, it's just the way it shows the people that are, like, truly against them because of their disability, the ex that Damon encounter, or not even really an ex, but who was dating Mei Fong.
Yeah, her coworker.
Her coworker who thought that they were dating.
When they go to the club and run into the guy that Mei Fong was trying to shoo off.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that he is going at them for being conjoined twins, but then they're able to use their disability in a way in that fight sequence that is just like so funny.
And in classic Farrelly Brothers fashion, they are resisting the urge to fight this guy as he mocks their disability, but finally give in once he mocks the Red Sox for their failures in 1986. And again, very well choreographed fight scene where the two of them are taking down that goon and all his friends.
The 360 kicks that they do are hilarious. Yeah. That's so funny. Like, just that, like, I'm glad we get that. The idea of just them wailing on people, you know, as an advantage is just, you know, I almost want more fight scenes. I want to see what they could do.
More good gags and stunts in that kind of segment is when they start doing the blue screen stuff. Like, they put Matt Damon in a blue screen suit, and then at the same time, the editors are fucking around with like live VFX. And it's just like, because there's a kind of dramatic stuff that's not actually dramatic. They just have to get through it for the plot, like a lot of Griffin Dunn talking, because Griffin Dunn's the director of the TV show. And so it's like this scene where he has to do a lot of talking about plot exposition, and then in the background you have like the editors making Cher's butt look all big, and you have the conjoined twins doing all these stunts with their new blue screen technology and everything, and then you have that perfectly timed needle drop of Pixie's La La Love You, where the whistling comes in right as Cher sees her artificially enlarged butt. And it's a perfect little comedy moment. It's just like no other filmmakers are going to get through that exposition scene with that much comedy.
In a very simple like sense, just like making movies is crazy. Like, the on-set dynamics are like crazy. It's like a circus. There's all this stuff going on. Like, all these, you know, Cher has like her big ego, right? You know, trying to do this thing. And meanwhile, the editors in the back are just, you know, goofing off. And yeah, there's just a, you know, like that as a Hollywood satire, it's kind of underrated, you know, just in and understands kind of simple concepts about it and kind of just exploits it for comedy.
It also understands some deeper concepts about Hollywood, such as when the boys go on Jay Leno after. And I think the panel is like, what, the a guy from American Chopper and like Luke Perry or something like that, or Luke Wilson. But then it cuts to Cher watching it in bed with a shirtless Frankie Muniz who's eating popcorn. Just one of the strangest images and one of the most incisive images about the Hollywood satire of this movie.
Very reminiscent of Shaq and what's that actress's name? Julie, the mom in Freddy Got Fingered. You know, classic. Yes. Bed. Love a good bed cutaway gag. You know,
yeah.
I wouldn't think they would sleep together, you know? Always a good concept.
I love that the last stand that Greg Kinnear has, like when they're disagreeing about the surgery, because this is when the film basically turns into whether or not they're going to get surgery. Greg Kinnear's like, you know what? All right, fuck you then. I'm going to just go crazy because we share a liver, and just gets drunk as shit. And they like so many great gags, such as one driving while Kinnear fucking hangs out the window and just like snatches a purse. And they end up in jail. And then you have Dane Cook playing a cop in a very like Peter Dante way.
Wait, isn't Peter Dante in this movie?
The two cops are Peter Dante and Dane Cook.
Yeah, I didn't clock.
I was
Dane
seeing
Cook.
Double.
I'm such a Dante head that I was like, oh shit, yeah. Peter Dante's in this, and Dane Cook. Kind of that's kind of almost like before he blows up too. Kind of interesting. 04. Yeah. I don't know.
The after they get out of jail and everything, it gets a little more serious as they finally make the decision to do it. And who else do they have but to come in and do 2000 style bad doctor shtick, but Ben Carson himself.
Gifted hands, Ben Carson.
Yeah. Look, I don't quite know how to tell you guys this, but we lost them.
Dr. Carson, good news. We found Bob and Walt. Someone took them upstairs.
Oh, fantastic. By the way, the operation was a smashing success.
One of the strangest things, because it's at maybe the most dramatic point of the movie, and that is Ben Carson. And then he still does bad doctor shtick. They do the, oh, we lost him.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's not one of the better bad doctor moments, but it's one of the more weird ones.
I mean, it's like funny because Ben Carson is doing the shtick. Yeah. Like, it's great that he's there.
Better bad doctor shtick. Arrested Development, 30 Rock.
30 Rock. Like, there's so much more
Yeah. I just like the reactions in Arrested Development where that doctor gets, like, the entire family to give insane reactions.
It's hard, because there's a lot of Spaceman, Dr. Spaceman scenes. Right? Yeah. I think that's his name. Only a few in Arrested Development. But I have to be honest, I do remember that. I mean, this is just because I've watched the show more recently, so that doesn't count. I was going to be like, I remember the Arrested Development doctor scenes more. And it's like, well, because I watched that more recently. So that doesn't, that shouldn't be a parameter.
We also get a look at both of them kind of like getting used to being on their own is very like, it's played semi-serious. It's like they shift into like soft rock mode, but it's still light comedy, you know, like Greg Kinnear doing bad acting on set because he doesn't have any depth perception or balance anymore, kind of, and Matt Damon crossing the street, leaning over to one side, kind of. Like, it's very funny, but like also very touching, but things just start to fall apart and, you know, the show gets canceled and everything, and it's very much a they need each other set of scenes as Matt Damon goes back to the vineyard and Kinnear starts to struggle in Hollywood, and then they have their reunion with a certain homophobic slur reuniting the two boys. But here's the thing. Okay, so the scene is very funny. You know, it's Greg Kinnear being extremely dramatic, waiting till everyone clears out of the restaurant to surprise his brother, and puts on like a romantic song on the jukebox. And it's like a really touching moment, honestly, because their reunion, it speaks for itself. Yeah, there's no need to analyze that. And giving me direction like a guiding light
to help me through my darkest hour. You fag. Lately I'm a praying that you'll
always. It then cuts to them just kind of like back in business, but also leading their own separate lives. And you realize that the whole movie wasn't about whether they're going to stay together or get the surgery. It's about like how much distance they did need from each other, which was not that much. They just needed to be apart, but still together. Yeah. Like, so they're still running the restaurant and they just tie themselves together, you know, and then they're able to live their own lives a little bit too. And each have their romantic entanglements and, you know, do things they couldn't do before. And it's really touching. And it ends with the final show. After doing so many one-man shows, now Greg Kinnear's character mounts a giant musical written, I think, for or adapted by the guy who ran the hotel in LA. I love him just being part of their creative team now. And it is a musical adaptation of Bonnie and Clyde, co-starring Meryl Streep. And it's a very involved and pretty long number, which is something of a victory lap. You know, the movie's essentially over at this point, you could say. And you get all these shots of the crowd. And it's really great in a, like, as I'll say again, classic Hollywood way. Like so many of those movies that just end by showing the faces of all of the people involved. And I just love seeing all the faces of all the minor characters, and then it like breaks through that and shows like Cameron Diaz for Something About Mary's hanging out there and some other fairly classics. There, you know, it's like, oh nice, everyone's here, you know, all the boys are here, all the girls are here. And then ending with that final moment, Greg Kinnear on stage finishing that song and pointing at Matt Damon. And throughout that, the editing, you know, cutting away from that showcase moment of like all the people are there, you know, and just starting to cut back and forth between them. You see how proud Matt Damon is of Greg Kinnear mid-song, and it just starts to build and build and build. And finally, he gives the gesture that he was never able to. He is able to stand up on his own and from across the room, appreciate his brother for what he wanted to do forever. and it brings tears to my eyes. It's one of the most beautiful endings ever. And five bullets for Stuck on You. JT, what about you?
I'm going five bullets as well. It's a masterpiece. Not the funniest Farrelly movie, but obviously, as we've talked about, that's not what it's trying to accomplish. But that being said, it's still like amazingly hilarious, and like I'm dying the whole time through.
Yeah.
But just has, I don't know, I think it showcases like their heart. Like, I don't think there's another Farrelly movie that comes to achieving like this like level of dramatic skill and just like I don't know, just humanist flourish, which I think is present in all their movies, but here they're just like really letting, like, singing all the grace notes. And I love it.
Malcolm, what about you?
Yeah, no, 4.5 bullets. I particularly love, like, yeah, that final scene, because I mean, for all the reasons you listed, like, I never quite put it like that, but yeah, that is the gesture, you know, him being able to appreciate his brother from across the room. That is very, it's very touching, and just kind of yeah, like, it's kind of like their vision of utopia, right? If Cher was making art for the wrong reasons, right, like Greg Kinnear's production here is like the ultimate like idea of like art bringing people together, communities together. You know, they even have, you know, characters from previous movies, so it's kind of like, you know, it's almost like a fantasy, right? Because I don't know, it's like I can't imagine a real world experience being better than the one we see in this movie. It's kind of hard to
it's like, you know, if the afterlife was like you get to see all the characters from your favorite movie and they're like in heaven at the end, you know.
Yeah You know, it's like when I go see a local play, it's never that fun. I guess I don't know the people there, you know.
Well,
I mean,
so usually Cameron Diaz is in the audience.
I need to get more involved in the community. That's what it's telling me. But
or you got to stalk Cameron Diaz.
True. I just got to do one of the things that happens in a Farrelly Brothers movie, and I'm sure I'll have one of, you know, their happy endings that usually happens. But yeah, it is just, this is such a unique movie too, I think, is what kind of makes it stand out. And like what we were talking about before, kind of like the idea of selling this movie on paper. And like, I've seen the trailers. It's like, obviously they're not going to sell it kind of the way we're selling it, right? It's like only focusing on the comedy, which is, there's plenty there. You know, I think there's plenty to appreciate, but I think people were kind of taken aback of how heartfelt and sentimental this movie was. I can't imagine critics even comprehending it back in the day. Yeah. You know, there's probably a select few who defended it. I think maybe Armand might have given some praise to this movie, you know, always standing out. But yeah, it is kind of like directors like the Farrelly brothers kind of, you know, making this type of movie is something that kind of just scrambles a 2004 critic's brain, I think, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not something that they're willing to even entertain, really. So I think that's kind of something that's beautiful about the movie, besides, you know, it being actually amazing. It's just kind of like, I love when directors surprise us, kind of show us things mm-hmm. that we didn't think that they're necessarily capable of. And usually they're critically lambasted for it at the time, right? Because a lot, like, unless you're like a certain level of director, a lot of people kind of expect certain things from you. And if you don't deliver that, then it's kind of a disappointment. And only through, you know, mm-hmm. people going back and kind of reclaiming, you know, or, you know, maybe there's a better term out there, but like reassessing these movies. I don't know. That's definitely a good thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it is, I'm sure that's happening right now. Maybe not. Maybe there's, it is like the.
Well,
the
we're doing it.
Well, but like directors releasing movies right now that just kind of pivot in a way. Like, I don't know. That's always I think that's a cool quality in art, kind of subverting expectations. So yeah, Farrelly Brothers, something that we've always said about them, more than meets the eyes, you know, great comedic, you know, directors, but, you know, I guess they did get awarded for Green Book, right? I guess Hollywood ultimately did. Yeah.
Well, they only awarded one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Stuck on You. That's the movie we're talking about, not Green Book. So Stuck on You.
Yeah.
Great, great movie. And you know what? I haven't seen a movie about conjoined twins since. They might have written and closed the book on that. I don't know.
They close the book on every topic they open, probably. Not too many fat suits comedies since Shallow Hal either, other than Norbit. So that's going to do it for this episode of Extended Clip. As always, check out the Patreon. Look us up on there. The episode description will also have a link. $5 a month for an extra episode just like this every single week. The most recent bonus episode was on Wong Kar Wai's 2046. And the next bonus episode is going to be on a movie that Malcolm eventually chooses. But that is just a teaser. That's just a little teaser. But we have a lot of good stuff on there, so check that out. You can email us at extendedclippodcast@gmail.com. And next week's regular feed episode, we are going to be joined by director Mike Balandek, whose movie Job's World is getting re-released by Vinegar Syndrome on a very nice physical media package with lots of good extras, a little short film action too. So we are going to have Mike on to talk about that a little bit. And we're also going to talk about Paul Schrader's Light Sleeper with him. So be sure to tune in for that one. That is going to be a good episode. Anything else you fellas would like to say before we go?
Have a good night. Have a good day. Yeah. Maybe.
I wanted to tell people that for this episode, we've all kind of attached ourselves to each other. You know, we're all sitting like on a couch. We're all attached, kind of like conjoined twins for this episode. We're all wearing the same 10XL t-shirt that, you know, has three separate holes that were, so that's that. We really went method for this episode, so I just wanted to let people know that.
Thank you. I'm glad you can let them know. Also, just a public service announcement. Yeah, I haven't seen Dune yet. So, you know, if you're wondering what I thought about Dune, I haven't
Dune
seen
watch.
It yet. You're going to have to wait another week at least.
Yep.
Maybe, you know what? Maybe that next Patreon episode I'll have seen Dune by then. But it's like unlikely, honestly. I working at a movie theater when a big movie opens up, the great ironies of life.
Wow. Tragic.
Yeah.
Damn.
I'm not even like, they're not even showing Dune at my theater, but like,
I mean, good. I would be annoying. I mean, like, maybe not good.
Dude,
for
I'm getting
the theater,
I'm getting 30
money.
People a day coming in for Dune though.
And that's crazy.
How and they you, all how have tickets to too. Like half of them want to buy tickets. Half of them have tickets to a different theater. And they're just showing up.
Just showing up to a random theater. I think this is the right one.
Like, no, dude, that's like not even another one of our chain. Like, there's three locations of our little art house. One of them's showing Dune, but like, this is the landmark. Like, this is just a different theater completely. What are you doing? But, you know, people are stupid. What can you say? Anyway, we'll see you next week. Goodbye, everybody. Do not let a tear fall from your eyes.